listening to By the Well, a lectionary-based podcast for preachers recorded on the land of the Wurundjeri people. Hello, I'm Fran Barber.
And I'm Ewan Lowe.
And this week is the 15th week after Pentecost, and Ewan and I will be focusing on the reading 1 Timothy 2, 1-7, and Luke 16, 1-13. And we have Liz Bowes and Robin having a conversation about the Jeremiah reading 8, verses 18 to chapter 9, verse 1. So let's kick off with the Timothy passage,
Ewan. Sounds good. The Timothy passage I find fascinating because, well, let's take a moment and think about the context a little. Most scholars, I think all scholars really, just about would date this later, whether it's substantially later or, you know, within a couple of generations of Jesus. So, you know, towards the end of the first century or well after that. Regardless of where you end up falling with that, I think it is helpful to think through this idea that this is a, this isn't the, you know, kind of nascent fledgling Christian community that's, you know, kind of formed around Jesus.
It's this beginning to look a bit more like an institution or a fledgling one, yeah.
That's right. It's begun to establish itself. Now, I think the other thing to keep in the back of a person's mind when talking about this is this idea that this is probably post-fall of Jerusalem. And so, you know, you by this point we've got a fairly defined split between what it means to be Jewish and what it means to be a follower of Jesus. The Jews have had this very traumatic event occur. And so the Christian community, I guess, now we can call them the Christian community, are sort of out on their own, working out what it means to be the Christian community in this, you know, brave new world, and almost trying to find ways to ingratiate themselves with everyone else, right? To become a community that is accepted and keep their heads down and, you know, avoid too much trouble, having seen what just happened to the Jewish people.
And in an environment with increasingly difficult emperors.
Yes, yes, that's right. You know, by this point, certainly you've had Nero and then probably Domitian as well. So, you know, an increasingly entitled and bizarre set of rulers have been, you know, coming into play here. And so that's the situation with which we come into 1 Timothy chapter 2, which on the surface can be interpreted as a very authority accepting, you know, let's be nice to our rulers and follow them and do the right thing.
Yes, yes. It does read that way.
It can read that way. And I think that's very challenging, particularly for people who have experienced oppressive regimes and, you know, abuses by rulership and authority. I mean, I think Christians, having said that, Christians are pretty good at praying for rulers regardless. And, you know, experiencing poor rulership or authority might motivate you to pray more for them. Right. But I love here that this is actually a very, I think anyway, from my kind of post-colonial perspective, that this is actually a little bit backhanded, that there is a little bit of an implicit critique or certainly a leveling of the playing field by Paul or whoever we think wrote Timothy, where the person says, well, you know, yes, pray, intercede, thanksgivings made for everyone, for kings and all those in high positions.
And sorry, but these are people who culturally you would be required to worship.
Yes.
So what this is saying is actually, it's not saying it; it's implying it. Don't worship them. They are in need of your prayers.
Yes,
as much as the slave or the widow, etc.
That's right, and it's the difference between praying to someone versus praying for someone, which is pretty substantial, especially in this day and age, considering that if you're praying to someone, you'd be offering sacrifices for them. Oh, sorry, to them. I mean, that's how the Jews kind of got around the whole emperor worship thing in many instances, where instead of making sacrifices to the emperors, they made sacrifices for the emperors, right? So, you know, this is continuing that tradition of, I guess, the sovereignty of God and recognizing that amidst a time where that may have been increasingly difficult for the people who are
So it's both theologically powerful but pragmatic the way it's written here.
Yeah, I think so. You know, it's language that is, I guess, almost vague enough to kind of allow them to get away with it.
Yeah, very subversive.
Yes, that's right. And yet at the same time, it is kind of pulling down the authority of the ruler a little bit.
Mm. Well, I mean, I'm really struck by that for everyone. I mean, we know from the pastoral epistles there is a very universal focus. Mm-hmm. But, and Paul's the minister to the Gentiles, we're told numerous times.
Yes.
So I'm, struck by the universality that's here. And also the list of different sorts of prayers, the different ways of approaching God. Mm-hmm. Again, I think that this sort of piety is quite frequently brought up in the epistles, and you've actually outlined why in a way, because they're in a brave new world and they're seeking to work out what it is to live in this Christian community in this world. But there's an invitation here to talk about prayer and what it is and it isn't. And to, you might have a community who doesn't think or reflect that much about prayer, or you might have a community who only practices prayer in a couple of key ways, and this is an invitation really to extend to some others.
Yeah, and I think what's also interesting is to look at the end result or the purpose of that prayer, which is the second part of verse 2, right? So that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and dignity, which is...
Not smash the state.
Well, that's right, But at the same time, it's also not let's go conquer, those weird barbarians who are out there, which is what, very often the Romans would try and do to motivate people.
Right, of course.
Join the army, see the world, smash some barbarians and get a good reward.
Yeah, I hadn't actually connected that. So this is quite subversive as well. It seems to our ears, but it's potentially subversive. It seems to our ears to be, I don't know, avoiding some confrontation that's necessary, but this is about their welfare.
Yes.
In a new place, yeah.
But it's also this idea, I think, and when I read this, and my take might be very different to others, but I read it and I thought, gee, this is Paul, whoever's writing this, again, the author of 1 Timothy, calling the followers of Jesus not to follow leaders or rulers into conflict and into violence, not to allow themselves to get riled up into that, but actually to remind themselves that the Christian life is a peaceable one, a calm one, and ultimately, praying for rulers, when you pray for someone to act in certain ways, I think you end up shifting your own mindset to act in those ways, don't you? Or certainly you try and find avenues to express that.
Mm.
And so by actively praying for the rulers' authorities to act peaceably, the Christian community will model that peace and so influence the rulers and authorities to act in that way.
And it's about living out your faith.
Mm.
So I think as there was in last week's Timothy reading, some really rich language here. Again, they're talking about being saved. So if you didn't last week preach on salvation language and how do we talk about that in your particular modern context and what are we being saved from, or more importantly, saved for, you could do it this week. But that the focus is on Christian faith as knowledge of truth to be lived. And that truth is a person.
Mm. That's right. But
and a relationship.
And that strong idea of praxis as a result of knowing the truth, right? Because we know the truth, we live peaceably and well.
Yeah, there's that connection that mustn't be lost. Mm. Verse 5 and 6 is a very creedal-looking phrases, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
There's one God, one mediator between God and humankind.
Mm.
But it reinforces the universality of God saving all, which is mentioned so often.
Yes, and there's that wonderful embodiment of Christ as well, isn't there, in verse 5. Christ Jesus himself human, who gave himself a ransom for all. So, probably the biblical scholars would say that there's all a little bit of that, what's it called, that movement that, Jesus' spirit not enfleshed.
Adoptionism or...
That's the one.
Yeah, avoiding that.
Yeah, but anyway, that's
but, by... But, I mean, I'm also struck by this little fragment. We'll need to move on to the gospel reading in a minute, but he was tested at the right time, and which makes me think there was some sort of notion that there was a wrong time. I'm wondering if that's connected to the community's expectation of the parousia or whether they were, perhaps... being criticised that there was this gap between when Jesus lived and when they lived and how they were supposed to be reacting to that.
Mm. And I think one of the commentaries I read in preparation suggested that Paul is here, I guess, reacting to this idea, well, perhaps it's that, or perhaps it's this, you know, why didn't Jesus come sooner? Why didn't God enact his saving grace sooner? And the writer of this epistle is just sort of saying, well,
It was the right time. Yeah. Okay, let's move on to the gospel reading for this week, Ewan, which is Luke 16, verses 1 to 13.
Oh, dear.
It's a doozy. Quite a difficult passage. And
yes.
Personal note is I've noticed from reading this how often I've been where our family goes on holiday in September because I haven't had to preach from this.
It's a very complex, very difficult passage to preach on, I think.
I think it is. And while I'm usually one on this podcast, and Robin as well, is, you know, we might critique where the lectionary writers want to cut a reading off, you know, it's read it all. It's, you know, why have they cut it off there?
Oh, yes.
This is an opposite example for me where I would just like people to focus on the parable and leave out the little pithy sayings from verse 10 to 13.
Well, they become sort of the hand wave, you know.
Yeah.
Ignore what came before.
Ignore.
We'll just talk about this.
We'll just talk about that. Was all too hard, but would you like these little wisdom sayings?
That's right.
Which they're not technically wisdom sayings, but they do sound a bit
like wisdom sayings.
So I'm inclined to encourage people to look at verses 1 to 9
and grapple with
and it. Don't let 10 to 13, don't make that a way you interpret the other one. So let's get into this. We've got a rich man who had a manager. Now, this man was squandering the property, and incidentally that word squandering is only used at one other point in Luke, and it's of what the prodigal son did to his father's money just before. So there's a theme. And he's not an impressive fellow, apparently. You know, he says, I'm not strong enough to dig and I'm ashamed to beg. You know, he's in a bit of a pickle. The rich man's going to sack him, essentially. And he's like, right, well, I know I'm pretty useless at making it in the world on my own. So he does this strange move, this move that pulls us up short, where he basically goes around to all the people that owes the master money and slashes, gives them the reduction in their debt. And you might, well, that's ingenious for his own survival. So, you know, he knows he's going to need these people as friends afterwards. But then we're surprised, we're pulled up once more when the rich man goes, oh, that was pretty smart.
Yes.
Good work.
And then verse 9 is the one that really gets you, you know, make friends for yourself by means of dishonest wealth so that when it's gone, they may welcome you to the eternal homes.
Yes.
Goodness. Well, one thing that I found helpful right from the outset was this idea that Luke has this sort of very odd relationship with wealth and money anyway. The writer that we call Luke certainly doesn't really like wealth, I guess, or certainly, you know, views it as a means to an end that should be more equitably distributed rather than something to be hoarded and used to lord it over people.
And also he wants to point out, really, I think, with this reading, is how it is ill-gotten most of the time in the sense that, you know, this rich man got rich, well,
yes.
How? And how legitimate was that profit? And that sort of critique is built in to that. To the manager's move. I did want to point out Brendan Byrne in his book Hospitality of God has an interesting point to make on a sort of a semi-historical note, which that behind the parable might be the common practice where a manager who enjoyed autonomy and he's allowed to let out some of his master's property for commission or interest, and that would include some proportion for himself. And that was considered normal.
Sounds like a credit card surcharge or something.
And so what the manager does in the parable in reducing people's debt is to strip away his own cut of that.
Yep.
So he gets in the people's good books for doing that.
Mm-hmm. By temporarily relieving himself, I suppose, of wealth.
Which I think is an interesting point.
Yeah. I mean, by contrast, Tom Wright in his Luke for Everyone suggests that perhaps there's some dodgy practices going on here and that the manager is actually acting justly in by slashing these debts because the rich man may be charging interest. Now, I don't think that is as likely. I think Tom Wright is trying to kind of massage that to make it a little bit nicer, but it's not a bad thing to think about either. But I think the fact that we do find such varied approaches and attempts to read this shows us that it is a complex text, and I don't think you need to apologize for that if you are going to preach from it and sort of be upfront about it. It's not an easy one to think about.
No, and I am increasingly convinced, as I've thought and read about it, that this passage is saying is very real about the world. It is not naive at all, and the Gospels aren't naive about the world at any point. Obviously, we've read it so that we've domesticated it a lot so that we might miss some of the sharpness it's saying about the state of the world. But this is incredibly real about the nefarious practices. And maybe I wonder if it's saying, you know, we are thrown into these situations and rarely are our decisions between good and evil so clearly laid out. Actually, it's a series of very unfortunate options.
Yes, yes.
And that actually the powerful message here is that God may work through those less than good options that we might take.
Yeah.
And also for me too, that again, it's another parable where we're being told God knows we're not going to divest ourselves of our material attachments.
Mm.
You know, there's no naivety about it, the fact that we are really bad at that.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, when we make our little ingenious move, like this manager, God is able to see us and bring God's mercy through that.
Mm. And you know, reading it post-colonially, I definitely got that, this idea that often, you know, the oppressed, or certainly some of the commentators suggest that the steward might have been a slave, right? So the manager, I should say, which is the language the NRSV uses, may have been a slave, which means that this person is already in a no-win situation right from the outset. And particularly if their status is changing, you know, they're losing their role as, you know, financial steward. Well, what's going to happen to them? And so, you know, here what they've done is attempted to preserve themselves at the cost of someone who is, you know, the master, who is rich already, you know, probably ill-gotten. And so why would you sacrifice yourself, you know, to help this person advance their riches? Why not sacrifice the riches to preserve yourself? Which I think really speaks to, there's a growing movement around today of you know, dealing with labor and minimum wages, and saying, why are we allowing ourselves and our mental health and our physical health to be sacrificed on the altar of consumerism or capitalism? When instead of allowing ourselves to be and to, you know, kind of claim back a little bit. So really, to take your point there, often we do find ourselves in no-win situations, and, you know, we've just got to puzzle our way through that and recognize that God's not entirely displeased. In fact, sometimes the opposite.
And I think that's a word of good news, and like all words of grace, you know, you can be cheapened by then falling back on, oh, well, there's nothing I can do that's going to redeem this. You know, I'm not going to try, or...
Well, see, that's where verses 10 and 13, you can kind of bring them back in, right,
okay,
a little bit, I wonder.
Yeah.
As that sort of moral imperative that helps balance that out, where, you know, you're kind of fumbling your way through and going, well, I can't do anything good, but then 10 to 13 remind us, well, actually, there is a standard that maybe we should be held to or hold ourselves to, but that's the contrast. Sometimes you can't do that.
Yeah, yeah, and but God moves nonetheless.
That's right,
through our strategic, less than altruistic moves.
Yes.
This brings us to the reading from Jeremiah. Ewan and I are finished for the moment, but Robin sat down with Liz Bowes, who's the Dean of the Graduate School at the University of Divinity and an Associate Professor of Hebrew Bible there. She's done lots of work on trauma and Jeremiah, and they sat down to talk about the reading from Jeremiah 8 this week.
Thanks for being with us again, Liz. It's good to be here. So this week the passage is Jeremiah chapter 8, verses 18 through to chapter 9, verse 1. Another difficult passage from our prophet Jeremiah.
There's lots of those.
Yeah. And we did talk last time about how reading this through a lens of trauma could be helpful. And so if folk are unsure what that means, you might want to go back and listen to the part of last week's episode where Liz and I talked about Jeremiah. Let's get into this passage. And one of my first questions for you, Liz, is in verse 18, we have an I. I'm reading the Robert Alter translation here. I catch my breath from sorrow. My heart aches or within me. Again, we've seen intimate and vulnerable language in Jeremiah already. Is this the prophet? Is this God? How can we tell? Who's the I here?
We can't tell. Okay. And I think that ambiguity is there deliberately. There are a few places in this passage where, the second half of verse 19,
mm-hmm.
I think we're clearly
that's God.
That's God speaking.
Yep.
But in the surrounding verses, it's really, really unclear whether we've got God or the prophet, apart from when the words of the people are being quoted directly. And there is it's embedded in the prophetic role that the prophet is the one who is the messenger from God, and the message that the prophet brings is of God.
Yeah.
What we get in Jeremiah is what Abraham Heschel refers to as the pathos of God, that deep pain of God in the midst of all this destruction.
So Jeremiah is almost embodying
exactly
the kind of attitude or the pain of the divine.
Absolutely, yeah. And there's a lot of embodied language here, your reference to eyes weeping and it's a very much an embodied imagery, and that God is aching for what's unfolding at the moment.
Mm. And again, we talked last time a little bit about this is probably written afterwards, like people trying to make sense of the trauma, but we get these questions, one captured in verse 19 and a different one in verse 20 that are framed as quotes where the prophet is kind of quoting the people back to them. So what's with this question, the Lord not in Zion, is the king not within her? What might that reflect about their experience and theology?
So there was very much a what we call Zion and election theology, both are coming in here, that Jerusalem was God's chosen city, that the temple was God's dwelling place. And running right throughout Jeremiah is the sense that the people wanted to rest in confidence of that theological framework.
Yep.
This is the holy city, and God is here so that there is nothing that will destroy us because of God's presence. And then suddenly that's all been undone. Yes. And so that's a recalling of a very established theology that is really deeply embedded throughout this period leading up to the 6th century. And that gets flipped on its head when the temple's destroyed, the king's gone, the city's been destroyed. So how this is what we believed, but this is what we're facing, what do we do with that?
Yes, and that's part of this complex trauma, right, of the people, that there was a confidence that because the temple was where God dwelt, or God's name dwelt in various iterations, it would never be destroyed.
Yeah.
Like, because God is king. And
But, I mean, the flip side of that then, or the danger of that theology, is that there is we don't need to be accountable for who we are as a people.
Yeah.
Because we're guaranteed to always be chosen. I feel like I'm getting into dangerous theology there. I'm not saying interventionist God, but
yes.
But there is a sense here that people were overly confident that God was
kind of on their side.
Yeah. And this has been dismantled, that that worldview's been shattered.
Yes. And what about the second quote, the harvest is past, the summer has ended, we have not been rescued? Is there a sense here that restoration didn't happen quickly enough, or that,
absolutely. Part of what we see in the actual events is that there were multiple episodes of deportation from Jerusalem when the Babylonians came in. So a first round at 597, and then the major destruction in 87, and then you know, people in exile, but there was an existing community. And the belief was the worst has happened, God will simply restore us to where we were. And it didn't happen that way. So, mm-hmm. you know, the sense of this has happened, we've turned back to God again, and yet nothing's changing.
And, I mean, that sounds frighteningly familiar when we think perhaps of some in the church today who think if we just do these things, yep. right, if we just go back to that,
yes.
or we cling to that,
yep.
or we do this new program, there's various iterations of this, people will come flooding back in and our church will look like it did in the 1950s or whatever that, yep. you know. Yep. And yes. yet we can only ever go forward.
Yep.
And knowing that things are different and yep. have been changed.
And that going forward may well mean letting go of something that you treasure.
Yeah.
Mm. Which yeah, I think those hard. Quotes. Yep. Yeah. Yep. And the reference to the harvest is past is possibly a link to some of the festivals. The yep. you and the sacrifice and the giving, the tithing that goes with that.
And that those things have been lost.
Yep. Those yep. things have been lost. There's no restoration, despite perhaps going through the normal routines and rituals.
Mm. And the last thing I want to ask you about is this womb. We get some kind of familiar language here with this balm of Gilead, which the notes in my Bible say is where medicinal herbs were yep. grown. But this other language of a wound or an unhealed wound, there's no healing for this. Tell us, I think this relates to how trauma is defined.
Yep, absolutely. Yep. So the original meaning for the word trauma was an unhealed wound.
Mm.
And so there's an open rawness here that is not going to be healed easily.
Yeah.
And so the people are existing, the relationships is in this place of deep wounding at the moment, and there's no clear path about how there's going to be healing into the future.
Yeah. So, again, the million-dollar question, Liz, how do we preach these kinds of texts? Like it occurs to me one thing I think that the context you're describing and thinking about this as a text that comes from a traumatized people is a really helpful way to put some meaning and parameters around yep. it. And also, I mean, my instinct as a preacher is to always go big as well. Like this is one voice in the Bible. It's not the final say. So we've got to kind of – but what do you think a text like this might offer as a preacher that we could explore with people?
I think with ambiguous voicing
mm-hmm.
is the intimacy with God in the midst of all the wounding.
Mm-hmm.
And that even in those dark places that God is grieving intimate is the only way I can put it.
You know, yeah.
There's no separation here between voices and that there's a sharing, a presence in the midst of that suffering and the grappling yeah. with that, which I think is really powerful. It is God who's weeping. It is God's pain that's here. So that's certainly yeah. one angle. I think another helpful angle is that sense of what is it that you're not letting go of. You know, where are the places that you're hanging on to something that may be outdated? And I think your reference to the church you're wanting to say if we go back to the 50s when we had large Sunday schools and et cetera.
Yeah, we long for
something.
Often quite nostalgically, yep. sometimes for good reason because yeah. we have fond and beautiful memories.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But I also think it challenges our understanding of who we are as a church in society as well. You know, we long to be the pillars of society. Mm. And yet we're not.
No.
So how do we reflect on who we are in community, given that our ideal is that people will naturally turn to the church, that we are the moral upholders, and yet we're not. So yeah. I think there's an opportunity to reflect on old or false theologies even.
Yes.
And that even in places where things may feel hopeless, it's sometimes only in revising that we can find a way forward.
And doing that with, back to your first point, knowing that God is there
yep.
in relationship, in conversation, part of the lament and the ache.
Absolutely.
Deeply with us. Yep.
And I think we can look forward to Jeremiah 31, which is, you know, God acting, God yes. present, that there is hope into the future.
Yep. Thanks so much, Lisbos.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, everyone.
By the Well is brought to you by Pilgrim Theological College and the Uniting Church in Australia. It's produced by Adrian Jackson. Thanks for listening.